Welcome. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martin. Thanks for having me, Katie.
I love having you on the show, Patrick. It's always great. We're engineered and produced today by Jack Inslee. Thanks, Jack. And our
You're
studio
welcome.
Is located in the back of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, serving the best pizzas in town.
Have you noticed anything new about the Roberta's
thing? Pretty much every time I come here, there's something new, but they have enclosed this fantastic new space between the shipping containers in which we are currently located and the main body of the restaurant. There's a wood stove. It's nice and toasty. It's more seating. It's quiet, it's lovely, and it's just as adorable and charming as everything else they do here.
Yeah, it's like eating outside, even in the winter.
Yeah, it's great. It's just fantastic. So today's program, by the way, is sponsored by The Barter House. The Barter House is proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. Thank you very much. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, The Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about The Barter House, please visit them on the web at www.thebarterhouse.com. That's all one word. Or call them at 917-463-3076. And thanks very much, Barter House, for your sponsorship.
Thanks for that free wine you gave us, too. And we got a free bottle of wine today at Paul Newman.
A very special bottle.
Vintage.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. It's always cool to see that guy's face on your food. Like, you trust it.
I know, totally. And yesterday I was on the subway and these two guys were talking about a movie called Absence of Malice with Sally Field. And the guy they were talking about, sort of, they were law professors from Columbia and they were riding downtown on the number one train and they were like, what was the name of that guy? What was the name of that actor? I can't remember. He was such an icon. What was his name? Finally, I turned around. I'm like, Paul Newman, for God's sake.
How old were they?
One guy was about my age, you know, so Methuselah, and the other one was young. But no excuse for the guy my age. I mean, that was crazy.
Well, we're so excited. That gift came to us from Michelle Nashan, who's going to be our guest today.
In just a couple of minutes.
Yeah, we're really, really excited. We have so much to talk about. You know,
actually, I'm really excited.
Pure fast food,
but
wholesome
wait,
wave.
Patrick, I just want to acknowledge the fact that I am now sitting in the studio with two of the titans of the alternative food movement.
Are you including yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm including you. You
Thanks.
Knew it.
No, Michelle's a titan. I just introduced him to Drew, the chef, you know,
did Drew fall to his knees?
Well, Drew definitely, his face lit up more than he usually does.
Did he kiss your ring?
He's like, it's an honor.
I have no ring.
Oh, dear.
Well, before we get to Michelle, I mean, you have a beef. I think you're the only human in the country that hates Temple Grandin right now. And I know it's short term.
No, I love Temple Grandin.
Okay,
I'm not going to say I hate anyone, but I am mightily disappointed because I never burned a bridge, babe. At the end of this program, actually at the end of our interview with Michelle, I was going to be grabbing my bag and booking it out to LaGuardia Airport for a flight to Denver, where theoretically tomorrow I was supposed to meet with Dr. Temple Grandin for a tour of one of the facilities that she designed. At the 11th hour, almost literally at the 11th hour, I was contacted by my people at Certified Angus Beef to be informed that despite having had a month's notice, the plant in question, owned by a company which will remain nameless for the moment, had decided that the one and only person on their staff of probably thousands was actually not going to be available on Monday, nor would they be available on January 4th, which was the alternative date proposed by Dr. Grandin, whose schedule is so busy that literally those are the only 2 days in the next 6 months in which she could have accompanied me on this tour. So I am reserving judgment. I am hoping that my friends at Certified Angus Beef are going to be able to make this right for me. But
in the meantime,
I'm somehow not at all surprised that this plant just, you know, fell apart at the last minute and decided they couldn't let a lowly little journalist like me.
I think everybody, you know, they now grade restaurants in New York City, and you can see all these pieces of paper up, taped to restaurant windows.
Yes, grade pending.
A, B, or C. Well, there are a lot of people that have gotten A's. I think slaughterhouses need that same grading.
I agree.
I would grade it A to F, but A to F, let's pretend it's that. If a journalist or someone is not allowed to visit the plant, that's
automatic
enough.
F.
That's enough.
And, you know, actually, I'm reading one of Temple's books now. We're rereading it, Animals Make Us Human. And when she's talking about slaughterhouses, which she does a great deal, I mean, she talks about domestic animals in the beginning of the book, but the second half of the book is about agricultural livestock. And she said, you know, the idea that these plants don't want to have video cameras in and they don't want to be transparent, there's something very wrong with that. I mean, yeah. She's in the industry and she's a supporter of the industry and she's made some of the most revolutionary changes in it. And if she is saying this and the industry is still holding its, you know, dragging its feet on it, there's something very wrong with what's going on.
Well, Paradise would get an A. Dan Purdy in upstate New York would get an A. I mean, just I think they would get an A no matter what. Certainly they get higher than an F because they would let people visit. I'm sure Michelle knows some places, but you do speak to a very important issue, you know, we should be able to walk into those.
These places should be absolutely transparent. In terms of animal welfare and handling, there should be no question that the public should be allowed to view the way these animals are transported, the way they're loaded into the whatever holding pens they are before they make the trip down to the stunner. All of that stuff should be absolutely transparent.
Yeah,
there are plenty of laws in place that say, that govern what these things do, and the idea that we can't view this means that those laws are not being followed.
They should be graded. I'd love to contact the Zagats and see if they would ever go that far with their grading system. Service to quality 28.
Well, let's should we break and
come right back
with Michelle Nishan, owner of the Dressing Room, founder of the Wholesome Wave, and many, many other fantastic
projects.
Many
other concepts.
Said, honey, I'm leaving for good.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network with Patrick Martins, Katie Kiefer as your hosts. We're sponsored today by The Barter House, and we're proud to welcome our guest, Michelle Nishan, to the studio at Roberta's. Welcome, Michelle. Thank you so much for coming and bringing the family and making the trek in from Connecticut. That was
Thank you, man. Very nice of you. My pleasure.
Well, you know, it's a chore on a Sunday morning. I'm sure there were other things, but it's a rainy day, so you couldn't be working outdoors anyway, so why not, right?
Hey, listen, I have a Humboldt Hemp. We're by Roberta's.
Yeah,
that's a beer, everybody.
Yeah, that's right. Don't get any ideas, people. Yeah. Garden, hemp. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Really, really not a chore. It's great to be here.
Oh, good. I'm so
really
glad.
Appreciate it.
So we've known each other. I mean, I think when I first started Slow Food in 1998, you know, moved there, your name was bandied about from Italy, and we met, right, I think, when we started here. And we've known each other for, what, that's almost 12 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Actually, not that long. I mean, considering I've been at this whole thing for about 30 years, it's, you know.
Tell us a little bit. Give us some of the headlines. Because, I mean, we want to ask you about, you know, the heartbeat, the kind of health cuisine that you helped spearhead. But tell us a little bit about those 30 years for some of our listeners who might only know you for your more recent conquests.
Well, sure. Well, you know, it's interesting.
I'd be one of those.
Yeah. When you say that, it's funny because, you know, I did a TV thing not too long ago called The Victory Garden, and people will see me like in an airport and say, oh, you're that guy from that new movement. And I'm like, man, I've been at this for God knows how long.
Yeah,
but that people think it's a new thing and they're all excited about it, to me, is huge.
Yeah.
But going back 30 years, you know, it's interesting because I thought I was going to be a musician. That's why I love the music that you guys play, by the way. It's really unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't making it. And I helped my mom paint her house one summer, and she could count every rib. I was 6'3 and 140 pounds. So she clipped out ads and got me a job as a breakfast cook in a truck stop. Yeah. So that's that.
To fatten you up.
That's like, that's in like 79.
Yeah. And, bacon and eggs.
When I started working in better restaurants, which happened almost immediately, I was really blown away at how bad the food was that was coming in the back door. You know, perfectly round tomatoes, all the same size, pink. Mm-hmm. It drove me nuts. So I decided I'm going to be a chef someday. And when I'm a chef, I'll just buy from farmers and then everything will be great. Because I was raised, my mom was a farmer, my dad was a farmer.
Oh, okay. So you grew up on a farm.
I used to spend, actually they lost their, both my grandparents were the last farmers of the generation. It became unviable to do that scale of agriculture. So they were really forced out by
that
the whole conventional
thing. That was in the United States?
Yeah. My mom was from Morley, Missouri. Uh-huh. My dad from Browns Valley, Kentucky, a Prussian family that settled in the Kentucky territories in the late
1700s. Because I was going to say, how'd you get that exotic name? I mean, it's, Michel Nichon. Yeah. I would have said Alsatian maybe or something
like
that.
Well, no,
right?
Actually the area of Prussia, before Prussia was split into Germany and Alsace and Belgium, right, and all those things, the area that we came from was in that kind of like Belgium, Alsace area.
Okay, then.
And then straight to Missouri, huh?
Well, no, for my dad it was Kentucky. For my mom it was Missouri.
Okay.
And I used to spend summers on what was left of my grandpa's farm on my mom's side in Morley, Missouri until he passed away when
Where
I was
15. Where is Morley, Missouri?
It's in the Boot Heel, southeastern along the Mississippi River.
Huh.
Really great place. Anyway, so I knew what good food was because I'd worked on the farms, and I just assumed when I became a chef, I'll just buy from farmers.
And it'll be so easy to get them.
So in 81 was my first job as an executive chef. It was at the Fleur-de-Lis restaurant in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I went out to Oconomowoc looking for farmers, and I would go knocking on doors and often get the door slammed in my face because thought it was completely weird. And if I found folks that had something, it would be like, well, we used to farm that way, or my dad used to farm that way, but we do soybeans now. And there's some asparagus left down by the road. It just keeps coming back every year. Go and take all you want. And it was amazing to me that there were like no farmers at that time. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago. So the whole notion of finding somebody that's even growing an heirloom tomato hadn't happened yet.
Well, the green market in New York didn't even start until like right then, 79, 80, 81. Right. So even in the biggest cities, this movement had not, you know, penetrated to the people yet, it seems.
Yeah, it was stunning to me because I was raised on canned and pickled stuff. And, you know, my mom dug up our whole back and side yard in Des Plaines, Illinois, and planted, you know, what our neighbors called a farm. We had an above-ground swimming pool that went on the driveway because there was no room for it in the yard because she planted vegetables. And it just blew my mind that the world wasn't as I thought it was. I thought the way I grew up was normal. And then I found out when I got out into the world that something had gone terribly awry. So I made this mission of mine that no matter what I ever did, I would figure out a way to find farmers. And almost in a naive way, well, if I just buy from them, they'll come back, you know?
Right.
And it just, it really was something. But to see where we've come now from then, somewhere around halfway, I was actually, I think, suffering from some clinical depression because I was convinced that we were not going to see meaningful change in our lifetime, that we were doing this for future generations. But honestly, in the last like 5 to 8 years, it's just been phenomenal.
What do you
attribute
that
to? I'm so stoked
to
be alive right now.
I know, it's good. But what do you think caused that?
Well, I think a number of things. One, you know, Patrick came over and brought Slow Food USA here. You know, Alice has been doing her work for some time. Some under-celebrated folks, Nora Puyon, first certified organic restaurant.
Washington,
D.C., in a place that has a 5 or 6 month growing region. Mm-hmm. I think this incredible commitment by certain people to just do it come hell or high water, no matter what was going on, we were bound and determined to make this thing happen. And then all of a sudden, this thing called the internet appeared.
Right.
And people instantly had an opportunity to get information about almost anything that was an area of interest that wasn't pre-filtered by a network or something else. And the number of people that chose when they could just move in any direction they wanted to on a free information source started moving to this area in considerable numbers. And I think just that readily available information and the genuine concern, especially of our younger people today, just blows my mind. How many kids are the age of my 25-year-old daughter and younger that will go to a restaurant and say, is this local? Is this asking these questions and getting ticked off if it's not? I love it. Ooh, we're not going to come in here again. It's pretty cool.
Back in 1981, people would get ticked off if it wasn't imported.
Right. Absolutely.
that would be what would command the couple
of extra
dollars.
Well, that was
part dollars.
Of the, I mean, I won't, you know, go into the whole, but my history in food goes back to about 1979, 1978, when I first came to New York. And one of the first jobs I had was, like Steve Jenkins, was with pasta and cheese. And that was when sort of Dean and DeLuca had owned the category of imported foods, or Balducci had owned that category, those two guys. And then all of a sudden, Henry Lambert comes along, opens 6 or 8 shops, and we're making fresh pasta, and we're selling imported olive oils and Parmigiano Reggiano. And it just was like, people were just amazed. Mm-hmm. It was a miracle.
Yes.
And I think that was sort of somehow, it was a confluence of many, many influences. And then later, I noticed you don't bring up the Food Network, but I'm going to do that because I think the Food Network, although it hasn't really had an impact on the sort of local sustainable element, it has made people much more interested in food
and much more interested in ethnic
foods and
absolutely
the idea that there are many cuisines from which to draw and that it's you know, important and interesting to experiment with all of them. So
yeah. Now, let me ask, I'm so interested in beginnings because, you know, those key things that happen that then launch a career. So, like, how did you get that first job at Fleur de Sel in Milwaukee?
Well,
like,
Fleur de Lis.
Well, it's interesting because
from breakfast cook to executive chef. That's quite a jump.
I will warn you all that I could fry chicken and smother pork chops expertly at age 12.
Okay.
My mother could kill a hog, dispatch it, cure her own hams, cure her own bacon.
Damn.
She was a farm girl that cooked for 12 other siblings, her parents, and the farm workers, because the farm that she would have inherited was really large and ended up whittling down to something very small, but she was an expert cook. So I was at her apron strings. One of my first memories was standing on a step stool in the kitchen when she was canning tomatoes, trying to put my pinky and my thumb together to show her I was 3. I remember it.
Yeah.
So my roots in the kitchen go back. So there are a very short period of time from breakfast cook to Fleur de Lis, where any restaurant you work in, there's always someone who's working there because they have a part-time gig because they need the money, but they're working someplace better. Mm. So I worked at the breakfast place, and there's this one guy who was working there who saw that I had skills, and he said, "Hey, what are you doing here? You should come work with me in this other restaurant. They're getting ready to open another one, and it's $2 more an hour." I'm like, cool.
Yeah,
score.
No,
so I go to this
there.
Place, and I'm working there, and then there's this like Alsatian guy saying, "Your name is Alsatian. You know, you're Nishan." And I said, "Well, it's actually Prussian." He said, "Prussia is Alsace. Alsace should have ruled the whole thing." But he saw my skills, and he said, "I have a restaurant. You need to come and work with me." He was a consulting chef to the restaurant that was opening. It's $2 more an hour. So it's like, within a very short period of time.
That was real money, too.
When minimum wage was like $3 an hour. So I, long and short of it, I ended up doing a stint at Hyatt to help out a friend who was a sous chef. And then Hyatt dug me. So then they kind of put me into the system for a couple of years. And actually about a year and a half, and I ended up at the Hyatt Regency Milwaukee, Wisconsin, as the executive sous chef.
Now, were you able to break some of their sourcing tradition?
They couldn't even be remotely interested.
That's contract buying.
The weirdest thing in the world to buy one thing from one person. Yeah. One thing from one person. No, we have one person where we buy everything.
That's right.
It was so antithetical to the system.
We have a contract with them.
Yeah, well, yeah. I didn't even know about contracts back then. All I knew is I could cook. They had me. I knew nothing else. So there was a gentleman who was visiting the restaurant regularly at the Hyatt La Rotisserie, their upscale restaurant, which had gone downhill, I guess, and they asked me to come in and help to try to fix it. And he was so blown away. He was living at the hotel while he was considering where he was going to try to open a restaurant. And he asked to meet me because he had seen in like a 2-week period of time the food go from maybe not so good to better.
Yeah, right.
You know, in his opinion, a lot better. We met. He dug me. So he said, "I'm opening this restaurant. I want you to be the chef." So That's how fast it was. I went from breakfast cook to an executive chef in like 3 years.
That's fantastic. Yeah,
it's pretty cool. Yeah, I dug it. It was neat. It was neat.
And then tell us, so then that was in Milwaukee, and then how, what led you to New York? I mean, give us some of the headlines that takes you to the
W. Quickly, the guy who was the executive chef at the Hyatt Regency in Milwaukee really liked me a lot. He became corporate executive chef of a hotel group called Interstate Hotels. And they were opening franchise Marriotts. It's interesting because my fast trajectory to become a chef had nothing to do with my business acumen. It had to do with my food and the way I could lead my staff to do really great food. And at the Fleur-de-Lis, I was actually supposed to become vested as a partner. Whether we made or lost, made $100,000 a month or $70,000 a month, we either made or lost $100. And I knew something had to be wrong. And my partnership was based on a percentage of the profits. So I asked the partner, and he got all mad at me because I was asking these questions. So he threw a financial statement at me. And to me, it was like reading hieroglyphics or something. Sure. I just couldn't. I mean, I'm a high school graduate, man. That's as far as I go with education. And it was frustrating. So Steve Hall kept calling me, trying to pluck me. I'm like, I'm not going to work at a hotels anymore. It's all canned food. He said, listen, we want to do higher quality food. I need you, you know, to help me open these hotels and the restaurants in these hotels. And in exchange, we'll educate you. Marriott had just done this thing called their management development modules designed by in conjunction with Cornell Hotel and Restaurant School, where if you worked from within Marriott, the concept was you could start as a bellman and become a general manager, so to speak.
That's
so
he says, smart.
We have these things. I'll put you through. It'll probably take you, you know, 4 or 5 years. So I did this stint with Interstate Hotels, ended up coming to Connecticut, opened a bunch of hotels for them, went down to Florida opening hotels. But I kind of fell in love with Connecticut, and it was also close to Manhattan. And to me, in my mind, Manhattan was the place I had learned to be if you were going to do food. So I wanted to come back. It took me about 4 years, and I had learned I can read a budget backwards, forwards, zero-based forecasting, all that good jazz. I can do it now. And I just wanted to get back here so that I could be close to the food scene. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Eventually ended up, I opened my own restaurant with my wife for a while, Fleur-de-Lis, had a partner, the partnership went awry. I don't do the partner thing well, I guess, you know.
You've done it well with your wife, though, clearly.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah, that's awesome.
27 years coming up. But then I ended up meeting Drew Nieport of Myriad Restaurant Group.
Oh, yeah, Drew.
Chef de cuisine of Tribeca Grill as his corporate consulting chef, opened a bunch of restaurants around the country. And then when the W opportunity came up, Drew said, you need to be the man. They want someone to do all the food and beverage for the first three W's that open in New York.
And where were those? One was on 50th and Lex, right?
Yeah, 49th and Lex. And that was at the time that Drew was like 320 pounds.
Right.
And he said, there's got to be a way that we can open a restaurant where people who have health concerns can go and order anything off the menu and not have to worry about it. I have to do something about my life.
So is that where that idea was conceived? I mean, seeing that there were unhealthy people out there, and it a personal thing?
No, Drew knew it was a personal thing. When he interviewed me, I had told him that I needed to figure out a way to make a change in what I was doing because my first son, Chris, who is now 25, had been recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And with the internet available, I started really charging into research to figure out what I could do to give Chris his best long-term outcome, and started learning about type 2 diabetes, which is really terrible and affects people in our poorest communities.
Yeah.
And that type of diabetes, which is the one that's most prevalent, can actually be reversed, stopped by diet. It's almost completely diet related. And that, to me, was a huge wake-up call, because when I was looking at it, it came at this intersection where I'm like cooking white tablecloth food, organic, local, sustainable. And the only reason why I was able to do that was because people were able to come to the restaurant and spend $30 on an entree.
Right.
And it was killing me. And I knew that we only really were reaching less than 0.5% of the dining public, because white tablecloth restaurants are less than 5%.
Of course.
And though they tout it, probably less than 20% of all white tablecloth restaurants really are farm to table. In
true.
Any meaningful way.
So, I agree with those. Are interesting stuff.
Yeah, so that caused the whole heartbeat thing to happen. He knew I was in this mode. He was in his own personal mode. They intersected at the right time, and Heartbeat was born.
And Drew now weighs 115 pounds. So no, just kidding. No, he's gotten totally healthy.
He's under 200. No. Yeah, he looks great.
No, he does look very.
He looks great. Good
well, that's
good man.
Let's take a very brief break right now and let Jack kind of catch up here, and we'll come right back and talk a little bit more about Heartbeat, and then segue into fast food, airplanes, and beyond.
And we want to talk about Wholesome Wave.
Oh yeah. We are back with the main course. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We are your hosts, Katie Kiefer, Patrick Martins, and our distinguished guest today is Michelle Nichon, the owner of The Dressing Room in Connecticut and also the founder of Wholesome Wave. And we were just talking about Pure, your restaurant in the W Hotels. And,
this is
and
so
your
interesting.
Genesis.
His trajectory, you could just
fantastic.
Go on the timeline and you fill up radio time. Like, so it tells you we're at Heartbeat.
Right.
And that was, I mean, describe the menu there. I wanted to just...
Yeah, what did you do? How did you change the way you were cooking since you were already into the sort of, you know, fruits and vegetables being paramount?
Yeah, what was unusual?
Health being paramount anyway.
It's interesting. What was unusual is I was still a little young. So I was aspiring to... I was looking to be kind of like that, you know, three-star chef in New York. So it was a little fancier than my roots. Yeah, so I was. It was an interesting trajectory.
So it wasn't
for
smothered
me.
Pork chops.
No, it wasn't smothered pork chops at all. But when I looked at it, it was interesting because when Drew and I talked about this thing of doing a restaurant for well-being, you know, the first thing there were a lot of press people interested. So I was being interviewed by people like Marion Burroughs and Florence Fabricant and others. And one of the big questions I got is like, well, how are you going to come up with the creamless cream sauce?
Hmm.
And it perplexed me. I went home and for like three nights in a row had almost no sleep because my mind works best at night. And I'm thinking, you know, screw this. There shouldn't be a creamless cream sauce. There shouldn't be a butterless hollandaise. There is no substitute for cream. There is no substitute for butter. They're culinary
is good.
significant. They're incredible things. But if I'm going to refrain at the time, at that time I was refraining from using them because I hadn't dug deeply enough to find out that fat is actually quite good for you and you need it to live. And it's not the villain everybody thinks it is. But at that time, I needed to refrain from the use of it. So what I did was I said, I have to pretend these things never existed. How am I going to make sauce? So I started doing some cool things. You know, Jean-Georges was doing his thing at Lafayette and he was juicing stuff. But a lot of it was like juicing and reducing. Nobody was like dealing with, gee, what happens if you juice a sweet potato? Mm-hmm. Or what happens if you juice corn? So I started looking at the starchy vegetables, and I just assumed that because there was starch in there, something would happen. And I remember I was with Jim Ackard at Reebok Sports Cafe, which used to be a Myriad restaurant, because he had all these juicers. And I'm like, I'm going to juice sweet potato. He said, are you going to get any juice out of a sweet potato? I said, I don't know. Let's find out. We ran it through, man, and out came this beautiful orange creamy juice. And I found that when you heat sweet potato juice, it thickens itself too much. So then I started screwing around with allowing some of the starch to settle. Mm-hmm. Like I used to, you used to see starch in the potato water at the
Absolutely.
Bottom for doing gratin dauphinois. Let's let it settle. And then we found we could come up with this perfect consistency of enough starch to allow the juice to reduce a little and then it thickens itself. So we were doing things like seared duck with a sweet potato sauce with coriander and chilies.
Hot.
And the thing that I found is
when
we didn't
now.
Yeah, when we didn't use a lot of fat that you actually needed to use less ingredients. So it was like the sweet potato juice, and then we would steep in thinly shaved raw chilies and a bunch of coriander root and leaves, right, and then strain it immediately. And it was beautiful, where a lot of people at that time were saying, oh, well, if you're not going to cook with fat, you have to add more stuff for flavor. What I found is when you don't have fat leveling the high notes and the muddy undertones, you need to use less ingredients. So it was cool. So I did this. I did stuff. So scallops with, you know, if you juice raw corn kernels, it thickens itself. So, you know, seared scallops with this beautiful creamy corn sauce that was 100% corn and a little bit of huilacoche. And that's what we were cooking at Heartbeat. And then Ratan Tata came and encountered what we were doing. We had the first ever tea sommelier, who we found at Balducci's, by the way.
No kidding.
James Lade. Tea sommelier. I didn't know that you were the first to have that.
Yeah, we had, but he wasn't someone who was doing tea blends. He was buying beautiful, pure, direct from estate teas and using the right temperature and the right steeping time. And it was huge. We were a big deal in, you know, the magazines here.
There was a brief period where there was a chain of tea emporia. Do you remember that? Where they, it was very fancy looking. It was about 15, maybe almost 20 years ago. They had one on the Upper West Side, and they only sold teas.
Yeah,
and they had lovely teas.
Yeah.
Oh well, I'm sorry. I digress.
No,
but
that's
it's
cool.
Obviously
no,
that
but
that was part of the same.
No, but well,
period,
it was a big deal because we felt that if people were coming for well being, that some people weren't going to take alcohol, and I felt that tea had all the characteristics of wine. So if you wanted to take somebody on a kind of like a tasting tour that was non-alcoholic, you had to have something significant. But the India folks, you know, Ratan Tata, Krishna Kumar, those guys from Tata, they own Taj Hotels and. Mm.
And thus the connection to Pure and Song Airline. I mean, is that how the kind of Asia?
Well, that was kind of, well, it was kind of like simultaneously. Song was here in the U.S., but my name, I guess, had gotten out, which I was not accustomed to, because to me, I was going to cook until the day I die, and that's how I feed my family and pay the rent. And when you're in the sustainable food world, there are no sponsorships, there are no implied endorsements. You know, you're a spokesperson for like an organic company for free because you believe what they're doing, and they have no money to pay you anyway. You know?
Yeah.
But anyway, it was, what was cool was Delta came to me and said, "We're launching a new airline to compete with JetBlue. It's called Song. And we want it to be healthy food available for sale." So I designed that menu for them.
I'm fascinated. And this gets us into a big issue of the network, of the main course, especially fast food. You know, I always make the point that, you know, a McDonald's value meal costs like $7-$8 now.
Which is what, like last week we had the meatball shop on.
His is less. A sandwich and a meal at his place is less than
McDonald's. Yeah, a sandwich and a side.
So to call it elitist.
Or meatballs and a side, yeah.
So tell us about this bridge from, you know, being in control, getting your ingredients, serving it that day, to all of a sudden packaging it in a tray and knowing it's going to be eaten 3 days later or something like that. I mean, how did you make that transition to quote-unquote fast food or
that's a scale
prepackaged TV dinners in a way?
Well, for me, it was really easy to do because the process of making something so that it can be kind of like ready on demand at a fast food place, let them all remain nameless, is the same.
You can name them on this network, by the way.
Oh, can I? Okay, so I can say
sure.
McDonald's.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Okay,
yeah. They're not listening.
Yeah.
They should
I love
be.
That. That's great. I feel strangely safe. No, anyway, so the same, you can go through processes where all you do, you change the ingredients and you have something great. You know, and if you look at, you go to like street food, Asian street food.
Yeah.
Right.
Amazing stuff. Super fast. Super fast. Yeah, but it's great ingredients.
Yeah, but their cooking facility is right there. I mean, they're making it right on the spot.
Yeah, but
so.
here's the thing with, I think, all of fast food. And it's the thing that actually created our food system. Mm-hmm. Not out of malice, not out of greed at all.
Right.
There was a period of time where food and science kind of came together. And the American mentality has always been a little bit odd in that if somebody really loved a BLT, they wished they could have it every day. Well, the only way you can have a BLT every day is if you can have tomatoes 365 days a year. Mm-hmm. And then when we started discovering that you can actually pick stuff green, gas it with nitrogen, keep it indefinitely, and then hit it with a little bit of ethylene, and then it'll turn red wow, we can have tomatoes 365 days a year. We can fly them from Holland, whatever. When the price of fuel was so cheap, mm-hmm. you know, $12 a barrel, $20 a barrel, it was inexpensive to be able to do that. And it became more important, to the American public at large that you could have the same crispy chicken thing on a soft bun in Seattle, Washington, as you could in Sarasota, Florida. Mm-hmm. And that it tastes exactly the same and be exactly as crisp and come with those fries and, you know, whatever the dipping sauce is that I want, you know, with my nuggets. That became more important than anything else, that I can get this anywhere I go. I remember Lori and I were in Venice right after I launched the W. We took a vacation. I went to Europe for my very first time. And there was this family that turned a corner and ran into a McDonald's in Venice. My heart sank, and they were like, there's a McDonald's here. Awesome. And I'm like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
it's an interesting thing. I mean, just to digress momentarily about the philosophy that exposes, it's a sense of almost food security, isn't it? To know that you're going to get something that is exactly the same, no matter where you are, going to be the same price.
That's a flavor security to me. It's like, oh, I can get this crispy thing. I can feel comfortable. I don't have to go outside my usual box because we've turned food into fuel.
Yeah, I don't have to threaten myself.
We've turned food into fuel. So if I'm hungry and I have to eat, damn it, I have to eat. What an inconvenience.
Right.
Yes, that's
Let's
very
get it
true.
Over with. But if while I do that, I can cram down something that's crisp and hot and salty and it just pushes my buttons.
Yeah, it's got the right salt, the right fat.
That's all I care about because to me, food is just something I have to do. So if I'm going to do it now and I'm going to do it fast, I want it to please the things that please me the most and I'm going to get on with my life, which means we've subordinated food.
So how did you play all this out in the tray of food on an airline? I mean, I would think you would have had to deal and navigate all these things that you've just been talking about.
Well, some of it was addressing things that were already available in the what I call the airport and airplane food desert. You know, mm-hmm. you go to LaGuardia and it's early in the morning and it took you an hour or so to get there. And now with heightened security,
you got to hang around for 2 hours.
You're going to hang around for 2 hours. You've had no access to food. So you're there and there's a TCBY. Mm-hmm. And they have this really shitty yogurt. Can I swear?
You can say that.
Okay, okay. Yeah,
just now connected to the word McDonald's. You do have to keep those two
okay,
words separate.
Okay,
but other than that, no rolls.
Anyway, so you get this really lousy yogurt in a Washington State apple that's been off the tree for a year, and it's like $8.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So we did this deal, and it wasn't easy. I started talking to Stonyfield Farm. I reached out to Nell. She introduced me to Mike Havard.
This is Nell Newman.
Nell Newman, right.
Paul Newman's daughter.
Paul Newman's daughter. Mike Havard at Newman's Own Organics, trying to figure out ways to get these companies into Delta's existing global distribution system.
Okay.
We cracked that code. It was really difficult. It's like, guys, they sell it in pallets. Just buy it. That's where the contract thing comes in, the way, Katie. Really ugly. But we got it done. So on a Song airline, you could have an Earthbound Farms organic apple and a Stonyfield Farms organic yogurt for $4 on the plane.
Wow.
Instead of $8 eating this sugary, high fructose corn syrup.
Who knows what's
crappy, whatever the hell is in
milk
there.
Milk substitute.
In a year-old apple,
experience.
You know?
Wow.
So some of it we addressed through similarity. Other stuff we did, like Lundberg Farms. We always had a vegan thing on because there are a lot of people that are vegetarians and vegans that fly, and there's just, if it's a food desert for us and we're complete omnivores.
Forget about it.
Imagine if you're a vegan, you're screwed, totally screwed. You can go 6 hours in the travel process without access to food.
Yeah.
So we had like these really great organic soft tacos with Lundberg Farms organic rice and beans, mm-hmm. and then you know some silken tofu, things like that. We always had something neat, and they dug it, and it worked. And we were flying 35,000 people a day who had access to really great food.
Oh, that is really unbelievable. And so you already knew Paul at this point, and Nell.
No, I knew Nell, and it was interesting because it was around that time I had left Heartbeat at the W. The Starwood, you know, had this thing after 9/11 where their markets were crashing. So they went to this protocol where you had to buy from approved purveyors. So I had to leave.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Like,
you know, I went home to Lori thinking that, you know, I'm going to have the worst weekend of my life. you know, because I'm on this fence with my job. And when I told her what happened, she said, well, it's simple. You have to quit. Mm-hmm. So she's an amazing woman, one of the most amazing people I've ever known. But she sat down with me. We looked at the checking account. This was in November. We had enough money to last us probably until April. And she said, listen, you have friends. You're a valuable guy. You know, just you can't stay. I'm willing to take this hit. We could be on a grass hut somewhere, you know, in a Mexican desert and be happy with no electricity. So let's just take the risk. And we did it. But, you know, we did the song thing, and I was consulting, and Nell approached me one day and said, listen, I desperately need your help. My dad is thinking about opening a restaurant. I need one of two favors, either talk him out of it or help him do it so that we can follow the family values. So that's what led to the relationship with Paul.
And it ended up opening.
And you opened the dressing room.
In Connecticut.
4 years ago.
Yeah.
What's the town again? It's connected to
Westport.
His theater, right? He has a theater.
Well, actually, it's the Westport Country Playhouse is its own entity, but okay. He and Joanne loved and played at this theater for years and years and years, and it was ready to spontaneously combust, like in the year 2000. It's one of these things where, like many, many theaters, it was just falling into disrepair. Insignificant. The play Oklahoma was born there. My Fair Lady was born there. So they just said, we've got to do something about it. Went out, raised $30 million and fixed it.
Incredible.
But the restaurant was sitting there, and Paul's like, need to do something with that.
Now, he's already been very successful. He had, at the time, already been very successful with his Newman's Own line of desserts and
popcorn
and all these things. So was he an easy guy to come to the table with and discuss? Or, I mean, how did that work, that collaboration?
Well, what was interesting is when Nell proffered that question, I said, I will never get back in the restaurant business, because I was tired of fighting people to convince them that what I was doing was right. You know, it was really, really, the whole thing with W was very, very difficult. Every time they got a new general manager, I would spend 35 hours a week convincing that general manager and their new crew why it was worth doing what we were doing, because we were hitting or beating budget. But they felt if I could at least do 50% from the conventional system, we could really blow the budget away and everybody would get a great bonus. It was really, I couldn't stand it. I felt like I had to have a shower, you know, every couple of weeks because of some of the conversations I had to have with these folks. It was really driving me nuts. So when I got out, I decided that I had to figure out ways to move the system more to scale, because if we're going to have a sustainable food future and really have a really great local regional farming system in place, it has to come to scale. So I felt white tablecloth restaurants weren't it. So Nell introduced me to Paul. I said, I don't want to open a restaurant, but I will help him and any guy he chooses for free figure out how to buy local and all that stuff. So that was a process of a year and a half of three restaurant operators disqualifying themselves, not because of me. I always helped them figure out a way to buy locally. Like the first guy was like, well, I can't buy from Connecticut growers. They don't deliver. And I said, well, Paul, you have Newman's Own. You have a parking lot with 250 spaces with the Playhouse. What about funding a farmer's market? And then you get your delivery once a week.
Which did happen.
It did happen. Absolutely. So Paul really loved that. And we had amazing interactions. He was just such an amazing man. And I say is because to me, he's just not gone. That's all there is to it. So we would spend this time together and really started warming up to each other. So after a year and a half and three guys, you know, refusing to serve hamburgers, stupid stuff.
He pulled you back in.
He sat me down one day and said, Michelle, would you please just do this restaurant with me? And by that time, I had completely fallen in love with the man. And then dressing room was born. And it's been honestly the most amazing thing in my life. And again, Lori, you know, when Paul asked me, I said, I don't know, Paul, I have to ask my wife. And I went home and I talked to Lori. And she said, are you crazy? Huh. And not because he was Paul Newman.
No,
she
but
said,
because he was giving you the rope.
This is the first guy you'll ever work with that you don't have to convince of anything.
Right.
And it was like,
who's already on your side?
It's like that aha moment, you know.
Well, I mean, he had previously, to his credit, allowed his daughter to add the organic line to Newman's Own. I mean, he was already very successful with that. And then to the pet food thing. I mean, this is a guy who really believed in bettering
the food system. It's an incredible
empire. Yeah. Which, by the way, is a separate company that's hers.
Yes.
And she's just, boy, talk about a a brilliant, a dynamic, brilliant person. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And Nell gave Soul Food its first big. I was at the board meetings at Soul Food were always just delaying, you know, people from meddling. So I always love to say, well, you know, Nell and Newman's Own, are you familiar with them? They're going to be donating to Soul Food. Everyone's like, don't talk to Patrick for another 6 months. Let that develop
let that
itself. Yeah, it was a real honor. Well, we're going to have you on for one more segment. We're really honored.
At least.
And then we want to talk really about Wholesome Wave. And yes. That's a big thing. And we want to spend our last segment talking about that and some of the awesome work that that's doing. So we will be right back
with Michelle.
Yeah.
About everything. Oh, we're back already.
Are we back?
Oh, yes. This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. Our program today is sponsored by the Barter House.
Jack Inslee is producing, running the whole show back there.
And we are your hosts, Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer.
And Michelle's a real trooper. He drove in from Connecticut, and now he's also doing the third segment, which is really great.
So. Anyway, so welcome back, Michelle Nishan, and welcome back to the listeners. And so we have lots of questions about Wholesome Wave, which is,
yay,
which is, I think, probably the project that may be closest to your heart, I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
And you are the founder of Wholesome Wave. Mm-hmm. And on that project, you worked with Gus Schumacher, who was a former Undersecretary of Agriculture, or Secretary of Agriculture.
Former Undersecretary. Actually, if Gore... If the election would have stood, he did. I love when he says, I was once the next president of the United States. Gus was once the next Secretary of Agriculture of the United States. So really, really remarkable guy. Michael Batterbury, rest his soul. Introduced Gus and I back at that heartbeat time when I was at that point where I was almost at that form of clinical depression I was mentioning.
Yeah.
I thought we were doing this for the next generation, and I had told Michael I was thinking about quitting because white tablecloth restaurants and affluent community farmers markets were not going to save the food system. And he said, there's one other person I know that thinks like that, and you should meet him, and it was Gus.
Well, so, Michael's great strength was putting people together.
Yeah, it really was.
Putting Katie and us, you and Michael were on our advisory board.
I remember.
Still are, you know, for Heritage Foods.
Everyone who came in touch with Michael found somebody who worked well with them. I'm convinced of that. He was like sort of the human networking satellite.
And by the way, he still is, just like Paul is.
Thank you.
I believe that.
Well, his
really
work continues. Mm. I mean, nothing has changed, really, except that he's not actually present and speaking with us. But so let's talk about the genesis of Wholesome Wave, how that got its start, and then I have a whole raft of questions to ask about that.
Well, you know, simply for me, Wholesome Wave was such that I felt a desperate need, a real desperate need, and a lot of it had to do with Chris and his diabetes and learning what happens with folks with type 2, that there was actually this potentially advantageous connection between these people in incredible states of need, because most people with type 2 diabetes come from seriously underserved urban and rural communities. That's where the majority of them live.
Underserved in the sense of
historically
food
excluded,
or
yeah.
medical
well, no, well,
care
well,
or
no, it, well, well, both.
Education.
You know, all of that. Though education isn't quite the issue that I even once thought that it was, which is the happy news, believe it or not. But just underserved completely, historically excluded urban and rural communities, ghettos, trailer parks, you know, to put it in context for middle Americans, You know, that's those areas where people don't have access, don't have affordability, don't have enough control over their own lives to have the self-confidence to make choices. It's that to me, I looked at that and I looked at the millions there. And it's interesting because when I first left Heartbeat and I was consulting, I thought maybe the answer was in middle America. You know, let's go to the middle class. And I started talking to relatives of mine who were cousins of mine that I worked on my grandfather's farm with.
Right.
Relatives and friends of relatives in central southern Illinois, in eastern Missouri and southern Iowa and western Tennessee and Kentucky, that whole area. I have a lot of family down there. And it's when I hit my first serious bout of depression, because when I talked to them, kids who knew what a ripe tomato tasted like, well, they weren't kids anymore, and I talked to them about the food system, they immediately bristled, and they're like, all we care about food is that it's cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They were more interested in upgrading from a 12-foot to a 14-foot bass boat or getting the latest Nintendo for their kids for Christmas.
Right.
But if a really lousy loaf of bread went up 25 cents, they're ready to impeach the president. You know? So I'm like, oh, my God. I was on the board of Chefs Collaborative. I'm like, we have to get this out of the white tablecloth movement. I thought I was going to – I had this idea of bringing middle America, only to find out it was an absolute dead end at that time. So when I started really, you know, my research was deepening into diabetes, and I'm like, well, here's a whole nother slew. So Gus and I had been introduced. We started working. We had this immigrant farming initiative called NAFI, New American Farmer Initiative, where we took immigrant farmers who were replacing the heirs of retiring farmers whose kids wanted nothing to do with the farm because it wasn't viable. Put these guys on it, and they would figure out how to farm it because they were farmers in Cambodia, Somalia, wherever.
And they would also bring diversity to the local cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And supply, food supply, yeah, when
it
came.
Yeah, what was interesting, Patrick, is that we linked them. It was Gus's idea. Let's do a farmer's market in Worcester, because there are Somali and Cambodians who don't have access to land there, but they want bitter melon, fuzzy melon, long beans, etc. Open the market. And these guys are subsistence farming, so they're not charging like $5 a pound for a tomato because they don't want a Nintendo. They want things like shoes, a shirt, So they're not charging that much. And what we saw was historic, like third and fourth generation black families, Hispanic families coming to the market and saying, what is this fuzzy thing, fuzzy melon? What are these? Are these beans, these long things? Because they could afford them. And that was the interesting thing. Everyone talks about food access. I want to kill that word.
Mm-hmm.
It's less about access than affordability, because there are plenty of people in underserved communities that live less than a mile from a grocery store. But when they get to the grocery store, they find they can only afford to shop the center aisles. They can only afford minute rice, cup of noodles, hamburger helper without the hamburger. And so it's like, why go through all the trouble of getting to a grocery store when the only thing you can buy there anyway, you can get at the liquor store or the gas station near your house?
Yeah,
7-Eleven has.
So affordability has been a big thing. So we founded, I really felt compelled that when I saw that example in Worcester, I'm like, oh my God, this is the answer. Here are people who want the food, they just can't afford the food. And that's when the whole seed was planted to found Wholesome Wave.
And Wholesome Wave is exactly what? Let's identify exactly what is your organization.
You mean aside from the greatest thing in the whole wide world?
Okay. I'm willing to concede that, but let's explain
it's an organization where we work to provide access and affordability in historically underserved urban and rural communities, because we believe that once those two intersect, demand is there, and people will shift their purchasing decisions towards locally grown. And we've proven it. We're now in 160 markets, 20 states, working through 30 nonprofit partners. So we don't just go and say, we're Wholesome Wave, we're coming in and doing this. We find an on-the-ground nonprofit partner who is so vested in that community and so trusted and have their own style of operation, their own beliefs. And we turn them on to the innovations of doing stuff like doubling the value of federal food assistance, like SNAP, which are food stamps,
right?
Or WIC benefits, Women, Infant, and Children Supplemental Nutrition.
Which was one of Gus Schumacher's programs.
He created it,
right?
Yeah. He didn't create WIC, but he created the Farmers Market Nutrition Benefit Program that allowed people to use their WIC benefits at a farmer's market. We double those benefits.
Raise money so that someone can get twice the amount of food for the same value of food stamp.
Exactly. And what we found is that it we've seen redemption rates at farmers markets that accepted these benefits previously go up anywhere from 300 to 2,000%. The incentives go away.
So in other words, people do want this.
People absolutely want it.
And you're saying that there is an education, there is an educated group of people who are able to make that decision for themselves.
Yes, there are.
Oh my God, I could go to the, now that I've got this this double, you know, double my money, you know, program coupon, I can actually go to the food market, to the farmer's market, and really
and
buy something
good
that's
food for
good
my family.
Yes, they cook it.
And
here's an argument that we have all the time about
they do cook it,
whether or not people are going to cook.
They do cook it. And here's an interesting notion, and it's anecdotal. We're actually going to set up to try to figure out a way to have a way to prove this in our data collection, because we do collect data because we want to shift federal policy.
I was going to ask you about that.
We want to repurpose the way SNAP dollars are released. SNAP dollars, food stamps, are about $70 billion a year, billion with a B.
Yeah, wow.
Right now, that all goes to highly processed food from the conventional system.
Right.
If we could shift just 5% of that,
yeah,
it would be more money to fruit and vegetable growers than if they could shift 10% of all ag subsidies in their direction.
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Michelle, was how do politicians react to these initiatives that you're creating? And how hard has it been to get, I mean, for instance, they just signed the new Child Nutrition Act, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of talk in Congress about improving nutrition nationwide. We have, you know, Tom Vilsack, who was brought in, and Kathleen Merrigan. We were all supposed to be, you know, kissing their ring about how great they were. And yet I don't really see, I'm not seeing all that much concrete change in the way Congress thinks about food dollars. And so I want to hear how do you recruit politicians to advocate for your policies?
Key word is Congress. Anything, and I actually take a lot of Americans to task because there are a lot of people angry with the Obama administration because they didn't change enough in 2 years. For God's sake.
I know, right?
It took us 50 years to screw it up. No one administration is going to change it in 2 years.
No, definitely not.
There are such deeply ingrained interests that are funding these people that resist change. But on the other hand, and I'm probably going to make a couple of your listeners angry, but
I love that.
I point this out that, you know, George W. Bush established a program in the federal government called OSIPO. It's the Office of Strategic Initiative and Partnership Outreach, fully funded, $400 million a year, because he was so upset that so many Americans that are eligible for food stamps don't sign up because they find the process intimidating or because they don't know about it. He put huge money into trying to correct that. So this is, when we talk about food assistance, it's actually a subject that cuts across both sides of the aisle. Mm-hmm. So we already have achieved, when we first started doing this, it was like pulling the horn off a rhinoceros, going into a farmer's market.
What were you asking? What are you asking Congress? And explain. So I understand. So are you just raising money and then allowing, you're helping make the value be double? Like, exactly how does it work? You know, the real nitty-gritty of this.
Okay, so the nitty-gritty is like this, Patrick. We raise private money because to do a government pilot would take years, just like it's going to take years for any one administration to make any changes. We raised private money because we felt it would be easy for us to either prove demand existed or confirm that it didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And what we found in a very short 3 years is that demand absolutely exists. We're in 20 states because we wanted to show that it worked in any geography, urban, rural, didn't matter. In that short period of time, there have been administrative rules that have changed in favor of these programs on the federal side. Changes that would take years if you lobbied. We don't lobby. We're not a lobbying group. The way it works is we prove the incentives. We collect data that shows what happens to redemption rates in the neighborhoods that were previously accepting food assistance benefits, what happens in farmer revenues. Mm-hmm. We just got, Gus was at a meeting of all of the ag commissioners of the United States. They signed a unanimous resolution for them as commissioners to lobby for more specialty crop money to increase it so that they can drive more money towards nutrition incentives in their states. Hmm. We've already seen serious tranches of federal money through the states run in directly into these programs to support doubling. In San Diego, CDC HHS put out a grant of federal money that our program partner, International Rescue Committee, won, and got $235,000 just to double the value of people's existing food assistance when spent at farmers markets in San Diego. So it's we're already showing that there's federal will to shift the money in this direction. And so it's the Farm Bill is an opportunity. We're also doing this thing called a fruit and vegetable prescription program.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
I can't say a lot about the details yet because it's a pilot and the markets are just winding down. And we're working with doctors, so they don't give anything up until it's been really vetted. They don't even tell you early indications. Anything other than the early indications are great. They won't tell you anything. But in this, we raise the private money and we give to healthcare physicians in underserved community health centers, real doctors, and they prescribe enough benefits so an entire at-risk family can increase their consumption of fruits and vegetables.
Okay, let me back you up a little bit. They prescribe benefits. In other words, they are able to prescribe actual food dollars.
Yes, absolutely.
That people must spend at a farmer's market or on fruits and vegetables.
And then it's more complicated, which is the double value incentive program was pretty simple for us. This one's more complicated. One, because we're talking about scientific data. Because it's a prescription, the family has to come back once a month and get measured for height, weight, blood pressure, and BMI. So these are serious indicators. There's a coordination thing between the doctors and our nonprofit program partners on the ground who are already handling the doubling alternative currency, because it is an alternative currency. It has to be managed. But they will verify, because one family might spend 100% of their benefit. Another family who may not know how to cook or may not be confident or doesn't understand the food at the market might only spend 50% of their benefits, because not all families are going to respond equally. And we're studying the way all those things work.
Right.
Because we know this isn't even a farm bill target. Title 6, Section 4013 of the health reform bill is the area of the bill where the real reform is, because it shifts from reimbursing healthcare providers from providing treatment to providing measurable prevention.
Right.
So we're trying to prove a model of measurable prevention through food. So that's what the deal is all about. It's early indications are great.
Let me ask you. Okay, so to build on that, how do you demonstrate to the community, and also how do you demonstrate to politicians that the back end costs of health problems are costing more than the front end cost of funding these things?
We don't need to demonstrate that. They've demonstrated
themselves. They already have decided that.
They know. The Centers for Disease Control, a federal agency, has...
Why isn't there more of a public education program like there was about tobacco awareness, do you think?
Well, because,
for example,
because the industrial food lobby is extremely powerful, and trust me, the tobacco thing took a long time. It took a long time. The tobacco thing started 20 years ago. The industrial food thing just started.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so, I would suppose so.
So when you look at the billions and billions of dollars that these lobbies have to slow it down and to roadblock it the best that they can, because it is so not in their interest for people to stop getting that same crispy chicken in Seattle as they can get in Tallahassee, Florida, you know, there's a lot at stake. So it's going to move slow. The absolute survival mentality and the political will of trying to keep your job being more important than actually serving your constituency.
Yes.
It's going to take a while to unravel that, just like it did with tobacco. Tobacco seemed like it happened overnight. It didn't. It took years. It took decades.
Well, and people are still smoking.
There was still a little smoking camel in Times Square until the 80s, right? I mean, those victories have been short.
Go ahead.
I mean, it's taken a long time, you know, to do that. No, and people forget that the sustainable food world, I think people think so within their locale, their little immediate surroundings. I mean, they forget, you know, that we were a famine-based culture in the 30s. People were dying of starvation all throughout America, all throughout the world. You know, everything is much harder.
Also,
it seems global.
For a lot of the immigrants who come here who have come from very challenged areas, that getting, you know, making sure that they consume as many calories as they can, I think probably has an impact on their food choices as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It actually, the youth from those cultures flock to fast food, where the elders of the culture
are
all of whom are under 30, the elders. Because when they come over here, the parents are young, are still so
they're
solidly
still making
connected
real
to their food culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where we actually make our greatest progress is in immigrant communities kids. Because they hate grocery stores. They love farmers markets. They're used to going to open air markets
Absolutely.
And haggling with a farmer.
It's always the last thing to go, right? You lose language, you lose dress, you lose language much faster than you do. The food traditions might stay the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, very interesting. So how do you take... like, for instance, if you were to get $1 million from Bill Gates, how would that money go? Like, how would that money get spread through Wholesome Wave? Or if you raised $100 million, like, how would you, where is the challenge?
What would you
is
like
it
to
finding
see?
Nonprofit groups to help carry the mission locally?
Is it creating regional distribution, which is like our thing? You know, we talk about this a lot with different food groups, is the biggest roadblock seems to be distribution, aggregation warehouses, and, you know, just basically getting the food
moved around. No, that's a big one.
Around.
Actually, that's our next step, because what we've done is we believe that our programs prove that demand exists in these communities. We really see these communities as the heroes of a changed food system. These communities hold $100 billion a year between WIC and SNAP that they spend.
Wow.
And it's all going one place right now, and even just a small portion of it staying within their communities could rebuild these communities in lasting ways. So what we're looking at, because we're very, very aware of the lack of infrastructure, and just like small-scale animal processing facilities have been dismantled in favor of the larger system to drive the competitive advantage in the larger direction, so have value-added processing and distribution facilities. They're the meat packing case of the real world. And if you think about it, if we could have value-added processing facilities regional that could take the field run seconds from small and mid-sized farmers and turn that waste into a revenue stream, we could solve school food. The key is, and I'm going to make some of your listeners angry again, for us to take 1 million grade schools and invest the $75,000 to $100,000 to retool the kitchen so that they could actually handle fresh food,
right,
then double to triple the labor force to actually handle the raw food from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hand a grade school cafeteria worker a bag of turnips, a 50-pound bag of turnips, and watch the shock. Not equipped. What we can do if we rebuild value-added processing facilities and other food businesses around this subject by leveraging those monies, as well as the new Healthy Food Financing Initiative money coming in, almost $400 million a year through the Treasury that's only targeted at big box grocery stores right now. Imagine if you could take some of that money, build these facilities where they create real jobs because you need food workers to make this food, etc.
Yeah.
You can actually get locally grown tomato soup, scallop potatoes, lasagna to a grade school at the skill and the equipment level that currently exists. You rebuild all those kitchens, you pay that labor, that money's never coming back. No one's going to repay that money, right? But if you build a value-added processing facility with financing and loans and PRI money, the money gets paid back, which is good for the economy. Jobs get created. And you have local
and
food in your grade schools.
Local food is in your schools. And you don't have
Not
to...
Not that fresh
and
shouldn't
you don't
be
have
a component,
a
so I don't want to freak people out. Fresh should be a component in those schools. But when you can make it doable within the equipment and the labor that exists,
well, and also make
you
it something that kids will eat. Because one of the things that the Republicans use to beat up the whole sort of concept of better food in the schools is to say, well, they get a fresh apple or they get a salad or they get this or they get that. And it's going in the trash. They're not eating it. They're not eating it because they're not
The Republicans also successfully got ketchup classified as a vegetable.
Understood. I mean, so. I'm just making the argument that you know, for a lot of
By the way, I'm an independent, people, just so you know.
Not to be categorized or anything, Michelle.
Yeah.
No, but I'm just saying I like to play devil's advocate because I like to say that, you know, there are these other points of view that exist and that people think that kids don't care. And it's true. Kids love fast food. They love the cheap, quick hit. They love the grease. They love the salt. Mm. And I mean, it doesn't matter whether you grew up with a family that doesn't make any food ever at home or a kid who grows up, say, in my own home who, and I cook, I'm a former professional. I mean, I cook all the time and we never eat processed foods. And she loves great food, but she loves crappy be food too.
Yeah, but here is as far as anybody from any side.
Mind
of
you, she won't eat it in the school cafeteria.
You know, quite frankly, just to be clear and fair. A lot of people on that argument of the apple are Democrats too from the ag states, and the bottom line is when you're getting 70 calories of a fresh apple does not offset the other 1900 calories
that
of highly processed crap that you're eating that is actually causing you to get fat. Right. But just a quick breakdown, and this is for the listeners so that they understand how people in underserved communities can be fat and malnourished at the same time. On a 2,000 calorie a day diet, if 1,500 of the calories that you're eating come from highly processed carbohydrates, this is the way it works. And I can speak with authority because I have children who have diabetes. Anything that your body needs, cells to divide and multiply, need glucose. Carbohydrates give you the best source, the only source of glucose, actually. Your body consumes about 70 calories of glucose an hour in the hours that it's consuming. So that 2,000 calories, if you hit it with 500 calories, if you divide it into three meals and a snack, 500 calories and 300 of those calories are glucose, and it's from highly processed carbohydrates like Minute Rice, like Hamburger Helper.
Like Doritos.
That turns into glucose within 45 minutes. Your body takes 70 calories. Whatever your body doesn't take, because we have a defense mechanism from thousands of years ago, when we overgorge, it goes to fat stores because we're geared to wait 2 or 3 days before our next meal sometimes. It takes 70 calories, and those other couple of hundred calories go to fat stores. An hour later, your body's looking for 70 calories of glucose, and you can't get glucose from fat. So you get hungry. You feel hungry, you're crying, you're whining, so the underserved community parent throws you a bag of Cheetos because they're cheap. They really should be about $3 if you took the subsidies away, but they're 69 cents.
Right.
You know, but you throw them more processed.
And that's 230 calories per. I mean, I checked this out because I'm a label reader, but those little like 6 ounce portions, that's Doritos, 230 calories for a little bag.
So what happens is you're getting hungry every couple of hours because the food that you ate went to fat stores. And you wonder how people can be overweight and malnourished. Yeah. That sums it up in a quick drop of a dime. I need to that. Because
Thank you for really spelling that out.
I mean, one of the things I took most away from this interview is, you know, not all people are starting off on the same plane, you know, in terms of access to food or something. Yet, once given that opportunity, like everybody, they all start to better themselves. They all start to kick ass. It's just that if not, you know, not everyone starts on an even plane, but when the plane is even, everybody takes advantage of the smart things, the right things, they're curious, they're intelligent in the same way that everyone else is,
very,
you know,
true.
And I think that's a big thing that people forget. They think either they don't care or that they know, or that if given it, they won't do anything with it. And that's not fair either. You know, so very interesting.
Here's the beautiful thing. Food is the great equalizer, period. When everybody has access and everybody has equal affordability, food can solve it all. Mm-hmm. Environment, farmer income, human health.
Pleasure.
Yeah, jobs.
Yep.
Pleasure. I mean, we had the Blue Marble Ice Cream Ladies. They opened their third outlet in Rwanda. You know, because pleasure is an important part as well. So anyway, wow, what an honor. I mean, Michelle, next time you come in, we have to, you know, I don't know who you could come in with Nell or with Gus. We've been asking.
Oh, Gus would love it.
You know, I would love
to. His son Andy owns the new place over in Cobble Hill called Brooklyn.
Oh.
It's spelled the old Dutch way of Brooklyn, but that's his son-in-law. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Gus has bought turkeys from us before. So
Andy Karras, good guy.
Yeah, so we got to have him. We got to have the chef from Brooklyn. But this is a real honor because Katie correctly stated, you are a titan of the food world. Like, there are all these chefs. Michelle's
been
I didn't
like
dress appropriately.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
how
do
people donate
Thank you
to
very
Wholesome
much.
Wave?
WholesomeWave.org, www.WholesomeWave.org.
Check it out, folks. It's a great website. It's got tons of information about programs that are ongoing. You can read press. You can read about all the people who are involved. I studied up myself last night quite extensively. So
you can taste some of Michelle's work at the
dressing room
in Westport. Yep. So enjoy your lunch.
And
at
Michelle,
Roberta's.
You have two cookbooks, and I think a third came out this past spring, right?
Yes, Sustainably Delicious.
Thank you.
Wow,
you're
very welcome. You guys are awesome.
Yeah, I try to hit all the right notes.
It's all Jack in the producer booth.
Go, Jack.
He's like, don't forget to mention Michelle's 12th grade essay on creating a better food shed for my... Anyway, we will be back in 30 seconds and do a little brief summary on some of the best things happening at HRN in 2011.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Will sing and Mary. Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Well, Mary. Yeah. Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Cause Pharaoh's on
me. Pharaoh's on.
Don't you know they've been drowned?
Drowned in the Red Sea.
Singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you leave.
Tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
One more time, singing it.
I could.
I believe that I would.
I sure
I'm gonna stand my foot on that rock where Moses stood.
Moses stood.
Cause Pharaoh's on.
Pharaoh's on.
Don't you know they got drowned?
Drowned in the Red Sea.
Singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you
tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
One more time, singing
if.
I'm
standing on the rock
where Moses
stood.
Cause Pharaoh's on.
Pharaoh's on.
Don't you know that I've been drowned?
Drowned in the Red Sea.
Singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you?
Well, I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you?
Well, I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you leave.
They gotta need somebody else to help me.
Oh,
call Mary.
Mary, don't you leave.
Oh, Mary, don't you leave. I believe I'm gonna call her.
Oh, Mary,
one more time.
Oh,
Mary, singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you leave.
Well, somebody needs to tell it to Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you
leave. She don't have to cry.
Oh,
no. Tell you serve a mighty God.
Oh, Mary, don't you
don't have to worry about your problems.
Oh, Mary,
don't we all know? I'm not worried about tomorrow.
Mary, don't
for
you
your
leave.
Joy, for your sorrow. Won't you cry?
Oh, Mary,
no
don't
more.
Oh, Mary, don't you
I know you got problems.
Oh, Mary,
but don't
you
cause Pharaoh's army's been drowned.
Oh,
drowned in the sea. Tell Martha not to moan.
Okay, this is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime and co-host and co-founder and founder of Heritage Radio Network, Patrick Martins.
You can call yourself
I'm going to call you a titan from now on. You
like
are a
that.
Titan of the food industry. And I must say
I like that.
Our previous guest, Michelle Nichon, who so generously gave us like an hour and a quarter, was just absolutely awesome.
He's
awesome,
a titan.
Awesome guy. He is a titan. But hey, come on, you're right up there with you.
You were alive when the real titans were around.
I was. Exactly. That's why I know, Patrick. I can tell by the mighty length of his legs and all that stuff. What is it? You know, in the
yep.
Anyway, we are sponsored today by the Barter House. I just want to mention that one more time. And if you're interested in learning more about Barter House, go to their website at www.thebarterhouse.com or you can call them at 917-463-3076. And we have like a quick hit with a couple of out-of-towners.
New Orleans people. I would say New Orleans
from
and a
NOLA.
New Orleans accent, but I don't know how to do
Nolens.
That. Nolens. So,
but
guys,
you guys don't have a New Orleans accent.
Pizza world. We have Michael Friedman and your full name?
Greg Algarden.
Greg Algarden.
And neither one of you are natives to New Orleans.
No, we are both,
I can tell.
Both New Yorkers, so we don't have New Orleans accents either.
Did you go down there after Katrina? To like help jumpstart the economy?
We both went to school down there. We both went to Tulane. And I was there the year before the storm. Greg came. That was your freshman year, yeah.
Yeah.
Greg, you need to speak closer to your microphone.
And now tell us, so you went down to school there, and did you see a need? You saw some market that was not being serviced? And
yeah,
you
in
decided...
a big food town.
Yeah, I mean, it has tons of food. It's
enough
missing.
Of the muffaletta.
Yeah, you know, you love pizza. You come from New York and you want pizza, and it wasn't there, the kind that we like. You know, they're really like heavy on the toppings and,
really?
You know, like thicker crust, and it wasn't a place you could just go and like get a regular slice of pizza. And we've always talked about it. We became friends and roommates, and then we had some weird fantasy about opening up a pizza place.
So you grew up on the New York slice, both of you guys,
yeah,
both born and raised in the city.
Long Island.
Queens. Rockaway, Queens, yeah.
So, and is that what you were imagining, or
it was
is
like
that
Ray's
what you were
famous?
Missing?
The slice, you know, that we grew up, it wasn't the same exact slice, but it was
idea. I mean, you just have this thing that never leaves you, I think. You just like want pizza. And you know, we got used to pizza's never horrible. Mm-hmm. It's always good. It's cheese, there's sauce, there's bread. That's great. But like,
yeah, soaks up the booze.
Right. and so we're just like, we just crave this certain type of pizza. And one day we borrowed our roommate's baking book and made a little pizza at home. And we're like, yeah, this is kind of better than like most things we've had down here. And like, we don't even know what we're doing. And
We don't even have a pizza stone.
Yeah, this is great.
Good for you.
So,
You had no culinary background, I'm guessing.
At the time, not so much. But I've been cooking now at a restaurant for a year and a half to kind of figure that all out. But,
so is your what's the name of your place? You're up and running or no? It's still in the planning stages.
We have a place that's not really a place. It's called Pizza Delicious. It's open only on Sundays. We work out of a commercial kitchen in the Bywater neighborhood. Uh-huh. And we share the space with some other people, but Sunday is kind of our day. And we get a weird like drug dealer cell phone and people call the number. We don't ever like list our address. We just started flyering and people... just been calling and pick up only 18-inch, you know, New York pies and do a couple specials.
It's like
every
a gorilla
week.
Pizza business.
It's sort of, yeah.
That's way cool, you guys.
There's actually a lot in common with Roberta's kind of do it yourself. No necessary previous knowledge of how anything works, but you
no unnecessary infrastructure.
Yeah,
or exactly. Diplomas, or you know.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, we've been hearing about Roberta's for a while, and a lot of people have told us, you know, you're like, you got to get back to New York, check out Roberta's, and it's our first time here. And this is kind of like fleshed out what we do, I think, which is so cool, and it's so good.
What's been the biggest challenge, then? Is it getting the taste right? Is it finding the right staff, or, I mean, raising money?
It's, you know, changes. It's different, I think. What do you think,
Ray? It's managing the demand, I'd say, that people want to come, and we have to figure out how to best serve them in a way that works for us, but also puts us in a good light, kind mm-hmm. of. You know what I mean?
It's a crazy thing now because we only have this one oven. We can only make the pizza so quickly. We put out a pizza every 3 minutes, and we have like a reservation book, and people call, and we're like, all right, you're the 609 pie. And people come, and they drive from wherever in the city.
That's
and,
funny.
And
this is really a great model.
It's
I
like
love
a
it.
Train.
it is very much. It's been crazy though. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger each week, and we've been getting a little publicity. And
you're only open on Sundays though,
just yeah. Sundays.
And how, from noon to midnight, or
it's 5 p.m. is our first pie that we put out, but people have been calling now like all day on Sundays and reserving
to reserve
pies.
Their pie.
Yeah.
And how do you get your ingredients for just one day worth of stuff? Does someone go to market on Friday, or do you get deliveries to this place just on Sunday morning?
We have a little setup the whole week with a couple like local purveyors. There's a great deli down there, Stein's Deli. They help us source some of our stuff, and it's like that, you know, and we just try and get enough to use, but we'll like sell out of things. And
what are your top three
yeah,
pies
thank you.
And
same
price
question.
Points
our pies are all our cheese pies. We try and keep it really cheap. It's $12, and you know, our what's our a peppadew pie, and then we make it a little arugula salad with parmesan and lemon juice and, you know, salt and pepper, and put it on the pie after
yeah.
it comes out
yeah.
and wilts a little bit. It's nice. And what else? You have broccoli rabe and pancetta. What else? What's your other favorite there, buddy?
We make a puttanesca sauce pizza, which is really good.
Oh, nice.
Really spicy, kind of rich, flavorful, you know, with really good anchovies and capers and olives, and that's the tomato sauce, and it's just cheese.
Cool.
Mozzarella cheese. It's
very interesting. Powder. So tell our listeners how to find you.
Check us out at pizzadelicious.blogspot.com. We have a Facebook group.
Facebook, I'm sure Jack is linking to you as we speak.
So when people go down to New Orleans, they know where to go when they need a slice of New York life.
Yeah, 504-676-8482.
Is that the times when the pizzas come out? No, right?
It is, actually. That's
How's
a
New Orleans
code.
Doing, you guys?
It's on the mend. You know, a lot of places are good that can afford to be good, and the places that didn't have money before that storm are still
don't
struggling.
Have money. Yeah.
Yeah, those things take a lot longer than people think.
Well, especially when the federal government basically abandons you completely.
Yeah. I just saw Sarah Palin go down to Haiti. I'm like,
I know,
oh,
me too.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
Did you just realize that happened?
Yeah, exactly.
You
know? Yeah.
That's cute. She's yeah. probably just going hunting down
hunting,
there.
Hunting, yeah, exactly.
Oh, she's currying favor with the church.
Well, this is, you know, thank you guys so much for coming. Wish you the best
thank
of
you.
Luck. Hopefully one day you'll be as packed as Roberta's.
Yep.
Certainly people who do it themselves, we're big supporters
yeah,
of that.
Like
so
that.
Next time you're in the city or if you have some huge event, you can call in and give HRN a little update on it. We'll be back next week with a great show, which will, among other things, look to 2011, to
That's
the
right.
future.
To our new themes and our new guests.
And,
our thanks to Barterhouse for sponsoring this program. Our thanks to Jack for doing such a great job all by his lonesome in the studio. Next up is Ann Sachs. No,
next up is Steve Pope, who's
going to
talk about
sorry.
Heritage Poultry. And then Ann Sachs will be is going to talk about curds and whey.
Whey.
Church on
Hey, this is Chef Steve with Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. And today, the Christmas bug has hit me. Usually I'm not too much into Christmas until the holiday really begins. It seems like Christmas shopping and everything starts earlier and earlier every year. And now I've even been seeing in the store stuff as early as August. So I kind of hold back on Christmas and kind of make it more of an event for me. And it's certainly a nostalgic one, comes a little later for me. I've often wondered why Christmas comes in a little later for me, and I began to realize that Christmas in my German home was quite a different event because of my grandparents and how they handled Christmas. And actually, Christmas really didn't happen until Christmas Eve, and it made it such an event. We were all looking forward to that. My grandparents had a Christmas room, which really was one of the bedrooms that they had every year would renovate into a Christmas room, and no one got to see the Christmas room until Christmas Eve, and then all of a sudden it opened up, and there in the middle of the room, of course, was the great Christmas tree, or the Tannenbaum, as we used to say, and all under that were a lot of gifts, things of that nature, and along with that came a lot of other events that happened around that same time, and one of them, of course, was the preparation with a lot of different cookies and candies. And I remember my grandmother making Lebkuchen and different things of that nature. It was a part of the Christmas activities. And I found myself sort of gravitating towards the kitchen every year because of my enjoyment of good cooking and things of this nature. So I always looked at those special dishes that were individual recipes that were prepared during that time of the year. And it was always a special dish that was created by my great aunt Emma. And it was a beautiful dish. It was always looked forward to as a main dish using chicken. And every year I find myself working closer to prepare that as a special dish. I don't do it every time of the year, but it seems to fit just that holiday especially. And a lot of people seem to like it. What it really boils down to is it's a breast of chicken with cream and apples. And of course, apples in the fall are always abundant. And I think that it makes the dish a very, very nice dish to have. It's very easy to prepare, and it presents itself at the table. It was always quite an event for us to have her fix that dish. Let me give you a little bit of the contents of it so you can kind of get a picture of what's in that recipe. You take there's chicken breast. You also use a little bit of flour, butter, minced onions, and you use 8 fresh apple rings. Now, I like to use Granny Smith. and you cut them about a half inch thick, so that means that they're pretty thick. Use about a cup and a half of cider, apple cider, and then you will be using about a half a cup of brandy or something that you like to flambé. Also 2 cups of heavy whipping cream, and then salt and pepper. Now, it's very simple to do this dish, and that's what makes it so tasty, is you dust the chicken breast with the flour and sauté them in butter with onion over a low heat. Then you're poaching these apples in warm cider until they go soft, and that's very important so that you'll get the ingredients of that cider back into the apple. And then when that chicken's nicely browned, you add the brandy and ignite it. You drain the apple rings, add the cider used for poaching the chicken, and you cook that on a very low heat until the chicken is tender. And, of course, with Good Shepherd chickens, we like to cook them low and slow, just as my grandmother and aunt used to do. So you're going to cook them for about 20 minutes. And then you add cream and continue cooking until the sauce is thickened. Simply season to taste with a little bit of salt and pepper. Put the chicken on a serving platter. Put the slices of apple over each piece, and then pour a sauce over it. Then you place it under the broiler for just a few minutes and let it brown. Now, if that doesn't sound appetizing, then I don't know food. There's one reason for traditions. They help us to remember our past, where we've come from. And we're finding more and more today that's become an important factor in people's lives, to look back and to look at their heritage. And during the holidays, that's one of the times to be able to do that, to pull out the family photos, to look at pieces of your past and say, this is where I've been, this is who I am, this is who my children are going to become. I think Christmas serves a lot of purposes, just besides the spiritual point of the season or Santa Claus coming into the picture. It's a time for family. It's a time for holidays. This is Steve, Chef Steve. I'd like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. We'll probably be talking with you next week. And try out that recipe. You might find a new tradition for yourself. Until then, here's good cooking.